There are days despondent with sleet, afternoons that rise into muggy chill. Still, the replacement sitters don't show. Watchman improves the rain catchment system. Maidenhair builds a urinal that works for women. Late in week three, the loggers set up to do some nearby cutting. But they're stymied after a couple of hours. It's hard to drop trees the size of skyscrapers when a pop of the saw and a slight breeze might lead to manslaughter. That night, Loki and Sparks arrive at last. Loki ascends into Mimas' upper camp. Sparks stays below as sentry.
Sorry we took so damn long. There's been a little infighting back at the camp. Also, Humboldt and their troops have the whole hillside cordoned off. Two nights ago, they chased us. They got Buzzard. He's locked up.
They're watching the tree at night?
We waited for the first chance to slip through.
The scout hands over precious supplies, packets of instant soup, peaches and apples, 10-grain cereal, couscous mix. Just add warm water. Watchman studies the goods.
We are not being spelled out?
We can't risk it right now. Moss Eater and Grey Wolf got spooked by the death threats and went home. The entire LDF is stretched thin on the ground. We're having some internal communication issues. In fact, we're pretty hosed at the moment. Can you stay up just one more week?
Of course, Maidenhair says. We can stay up forever. Forever might be easier, Watchman thinks, if he too were hearing from beings of light. Loki shivers in the candlelight.
Man, it's cold up here. That wet wind goes right through you.
Maidenhair says, we don't feel it anymore.
Much, Watchman qualifies.
Loki harnesses up.
Gotta head down before they trap Sparks and me. Watch out for Climber Cal. Serious. Humboldt has this guy who scoots up trunks bareback with just his spikes and a big loop of cable. He's been all kinds of trouble at other tree sits.
Sounds like a forest legend, Watchman says.
He's not.
He's taking people out of trees by force? There are two of us, Maidenhair declares. And we've got our balance now.
The loggers stop coming. There's nothing more to argue over. Resupply from LDF ground support dries up, too.
We must still be under siege, Watchman says.
But they can see no blockade down on the surface. Humans might well have vanished from everywhere but the fossil record. High up in the canopy, they see no animals larger than flying squirrels who nest in the warmth of their bodies at night. Neither of them can say how many days pass. Nick marks each morning on a hand-drawn calendar, but by the time he pees and sponges clean and eats breakfast and dreams some more of a collective artwork that could do justice to a forest, he often can't remember if he has marked off the day already or not.
What does it matter? Maidenhair asks. The storms are almost over. It's warming up. The days are getting longer. That's all the calendar we need.
Whole afternoons pass as Watchman sketches. He draws the mosses that sprout up in every crevice. He sketches the usnea and other hanging lichen that turn the tree into a fairy tale. His hand moves, and the thought forms. Who needs anything except food? And those like Mimas who make their own food, freest of all.
Equipment still whines down the gaping hillside. A nearby saw, a more distant trunk skidder. The two tree sitters get good at telling the creatures apart by ear. Some mornings, those sounds are their only way of knowing if the system of free enterprise still barrels toward its god-sized wall.
They must be trying to starve us out.
But in that long stretch when provisions don't get through, they have couscous and imagination.
Hold out, Maidenhair says. The huckleberries will be fruiting again before we know it.
She nibbles on dried chickpeas like they're a course in philosophy.
I never knew how to taste things before.
he neither. And he never knew how his body smells, and his fresh shit turning to compost, and how his thought changes when he stares for hours at the carved light sinking through the branches, and what blood sounds like, pumping in his ears in the hour after the sun sets, and while everything alive holds its breath, waiting to see what happens once the sky falls. Reality tips away from perpendicular in every little breeze. Gusty afternoons are an epic two-person sport. When the wind picks up, there's nothing, nothing at all but wind. It turns them feral, the tarp flapping like mad and the needles whipping them senseless. When the wind blows, that's all your brain has. No drawing, no poems, no books, no cause, no calling. Just the gales and your crazed ideas that bang around wild, their own careening species tumbling free of the family tree. Once the light goes, the two of them have only sound. The candles and kerosene are too precious to spend on the indulgence of reading. They have no idea when their next provisions might make it through the cordon, whether there still is a cordon, still an LDF, or any earthly institution that remembers the pair of them, high up in a 1,000-year-old tree in need of supplies. She takes his hand in the dark, all the signal he needs. They burrow into one another, as they do every night, against the black. Where are they? There are only two choices, which they she means. Three, if you count the creatures of light. And his answer is the same for all three. I don't know. Maybe they've forgotten about this stand. No, he says, I don't think they have. The moonlight behind her throws a hood across her features. They can't win. They can't beat nature. But they can mess things over for an incredibly long time. Yet on such a night as this, as the forest pumps out its million-part symphonies and the fat blazing moon gets shredded in Mimas's branches, it's easy for even Nick to believe that Green has a plan that will make the age of mammals seem like a minor detour. Shh, she says, although he's already silent. What's that? He knows, and he doesn't. Another experimental incarnation checking in, announcing its whereabouts, testing the blackness, calibrating its place in the enormous hive. Truth is, his eyes are drooping and he can't quite keep her question from turning into hieroglyphics. With no way to domesticate the dark or turn it to the smallest use, he's done for. But he's wakeful enough still to realize, this is the longest stretch of time I've ever gone without the black dog coming to bite at my ass. They sleep. They don't strap in anymore. But they still clutch each other hard enough most nights that they'd pitch over the side of the platform together all the same. When it's light again, he makes a meaningless tick mark on his DIY calendar. He washes, evacuates, eats, and crawls into the traditional waking position, head alongside her feet so they can see each other. It crosses Nick's mind to wonder how he ever took it in his head to move his life 20 stories into the open air. But how does a person get anywhere? And who could stay on the ground once he has seen life in the canopy? As the sun skids by in smallest increments across the summer sky, he draws. He begins to see how it might work, how a few black marks on a blank white field might change what's in the world. She sits on the platform edge with the tarp up, looking out across the tumbling forest. Bald patches in the middle distance are coming closer. She listens for her disembodied voices, her constant reassurance. They don't check in every day. She retrieves her own notebook and scribbles down tiny poems smaller than a redwood seed. He watches her take a sponge bath with water that collected in the tarp. Do your parents know where you are? in case something comes down?
She turns, naked and shivering, frowns, like the question is advanced nonlinear dynamics.
I haven't spoken to my parents since we left Iowa.
Clean and clothed again, 7 degrees of solar descent later, she adds,
and it won't.
Won't what?
Nothing's coming down. I've been assured that this story has a good ending.
She pats Mimas, who has that very day eaten 4 pounds of carbon from the air and added them to its mass, even in late middle age.
They spend the endless hours reading in their sleeping bags. They read all the books previous sitters left in the hammock lending library. They read Shakespeare, holding the thick volume across their twinned bellies. They read a play every afternoon, taking all the parts between them. A Midsummer Night's Dream, King Lear, Macbeth. They read 2 fabulous novels, one 3 years old and the other 123. She has trouble as they near the end of the older story, keeping her voice under control.
You love these people? The stories have captivated him. He cares about what happens, but she's broken.
Love? Wow. Okay. Maybe. But they're all imprisoned in a shoebox, and they have no idea. I just want to shake them and yell, get out of yourselves, damn it! Look around! But they can't, Nikki. Everything alive is just outside their field of view.
Her face crabs up and her eyes go raw again, crying for the blindness, even of fictional beings. They read The Secret Forest again. It's like a U, more revealing on a second look. They read about how a branch knows when to branch, how a root finds water, even water in a sealed pipe. How an oak may have 500 million root tips that turn away from competition. How crown-shy leaves leave a gap between themselves and their neighbors. How trees see color. They read about the wild stock market trading in handicrafts, above ground and below. About the complex, limited partnerships with other kinds of life. The ingenious designs that loft seeds in the air for hundreds of miles. The tricks of propagation worked upon unsuspecting mobile things tens of millions of years younger than the trees. The bribes for animals who think they're getting lunch for free. They read about myrrh tree transplanting expeditions depicted in the reliefs at Karnak 3,500 years ago. They read about trees that migrate, trees that remember the past and predict the future. Trees that harmonize their fruiting and nutting into sprawling choruses. Trees that bomb the ground so only their own young can grow. Trees that summon air forces of insects to come save them. Trees with hollowed trunks wide enough to hold the population of small hamlets. Leaves with fur on the undersides. Thinned petioles that solve the wind. The rim of life around a pillar of dead history, each new coat as thick as the maker season is generous.
Can you feel it?
She asks, under the mayhem in the western sky, early one evening, or perhaps the next. With no more explanation, he knows what she means. He can read her mind now. So many hours have they passed together in purposeless contemplation, knee to elbow, elbow to knee.
Can you feel it lift and disappear? That standing wave of constant static, the distraction so ubiquitous you never even knew you were wrapped in it. Human certainty, the thing that blinds you to what's right here, gone.
He can feel it. The tree, like some tremendous signal beacon,
the two of them turning into something powered by the spots of speckled sun that reached them through the dozens of feet of Mimas's branches still above them.
"Let's summit," she tells him.
And before he can object, he's looking up at a mud-caked gargoyle perched on a lightning-clipped spire, her legs wrapped around a pipe running all the way down to earth, and her arms flung up, sieving the sky. Nick is deep in a green dream one night, when a shudder rips through Mimas and rolls Nick onto the platform's edge. His arm stabs out and grabs a thin branch. He clings, looking 20 stories downward. Behind him, Olivia screams. He scrambles back to mid-platform as a bigger gust catches the tarp and lifts the whole construction, bucking it. Winds liquefy the air, and hail pelts them through the needles. At a tremendous crack, Nick looks up. 30 feet above his head, a branch thicker than his thigh tears free and crashes down in slow motion, cracking other limbs on its way down. Furious winds cross-check Olivia into Mimas's trunk. She clutches the platform, hysterical. The trunk tips several feet off the vertical, then swings back as far the other way. Nick swings like a sliding weight on the world's tallest metronome. As sure as he knows anything, he knows he's going to die. He's clenched from jaw to toes, clamped to life with all that's left in his body. He'll let go, and the ground will solve everything. Something screams at him through the hail. Olivia.
"Don't fight! Don't fight!"
The words slap him, and he can think again. She's right. Clenched, he won't last another 3 minutes.
"Relax! Ride!"
He sees her eyes, the crazed green celadon. She sways on the wild bends, limber, as if the storm is nothing. In a few beats more, he sees that it is. Nothing to a redwood. Thousands of these storms have blown through this crown, tens of thousands, and all Mimas ever had to do was give. He surrenders to the rage, as this tree has done, through a millennium of killer storms. As Semper Virens has done for 180 million years. Yes, a storm topped this tree centuries ago. Yes, storms will bring down trees this size. But not tonight. Not likely. Tonight, the top of a redwood is as safe a spot in this gale as any. Just bend and ride. A howl cuts through the hail-thickened wind. He howls back. Their shrieks turn into asylum laughter. They screech in tandem until all the world's war cries and wild calls turn into thanksgiving. Long past the hour when his clenched fists would have given out, they whoop, descant to the storm. Late the next morning, 3 loggers appear at the foot of Mimas.
"You two all right? A lot of wind throw last night. Big trees down. We were worried about you."
Incredibly, the police make the video. A year ago, it would have been the kind of shaky, blurred proof the police destroyed. But the tactics of the lawless are changing. Against them, the police need new experiments, methods that must be documented, evaluated, and refined. The camera pans across the crowd. People spill down the street past the burnished company sign. They surround the headquarters, nestled lodge-like against a rim of spruce and fir. Not even an apprehensive cameraman can make it seem like anything but democracy in America, the right of people peaceably to assemble. The crowd stands well back from the property line, singing their songs and shaking their bedsheet banners. "Stop illegal harvesting. No more death on public lands." But police wander in and out of the frame. Officers on foot and horseback. men seated in the back of vehicles that look like armored personnel carriers. Mimi shakes her head in wonder.
I didn't know this town had so many cops.
Dougie limps beside her, bow-legged.
You know, we don't have to do this. At least half a dozen people would be happy to stand in.
He spins to face her and almost stumbles.
What are you talking about?
He's like a golden retriever whacked with the rolled-up newspaper he just so proudly fetched.
Wait.
He touches her shoulder, confused.
Are you scared, Meme? Because you don't have to do anything, you...
She can't bear it, his goodness. Fine. I'm just saying, don't be a hero this time.
I wasn't being a hero last time. How could I know they'd melt down the old family jewels?
She saw the day his denim was sheared open to the breeze. The family jewels, flapping in the air, burned with chemicals. He has wanted to show her again so often since. The miraculous recovery, almost a resurrection, you might say. She just can't bring herself. She loves the man, maybe more than she cares for anyone but her sisters and their children. It's a constant amazement to her that a man so artless has made it to the age of 40. She can't imagine not watching out for him. But they're different species. This cause they've given themselves to, this defense of the immobile and blameless, the fight for something better than endless suicidal appetite, is all they have in common. They head toward the deployment vehicle, where the protest's new secret weapon, the steel bar Black Bears, are being handed out.
Damn straight we're doing this, woman. What do you think? That wasn't my first Purple Heart, or my last. Gonna end up with a whole string of them, just like an earthworm.
Dougie, no more injuries. I can't take it today.
He points his chin toward the line of police waiting for something to happen.
Take it up with them.
And then, like a creature with no memory except for the sun,
geez, look at all these people. Is this a movement or what?
The first crime, crossing the line onto corporate property, happens off-camera. But the lens soon finds the action. The automatic focus slurs and locks in as a few peaceful assemblers cross the parkway onto the manicured lawn. There, they stand and shout responses to the calls of the megaphone.
A people, united, can never be defeated. A forest, once blighted, can never be reseeded.
Two officers approach the trespassers and ask them to step back. Their words are muffled on the recording, but polite enough. Soon, though, the clump turns into a rolling bait ball. People challenge and jeer, precisely the standoff the police hope to avoid. One white-haired, hunchbacked woman shouts,
"We'll respect their property when they respect ours."
The camera swings hard to the left, where a group of 9 people dash across the lawn. The first altercation turns out to be a well-executed diversionary tactic to draw police away from the building's entrance. Each beelining figure carries a shallow, V-bent steel tube 3 feet long, thick enough to insert an arm. Then a cut. The scene shifts indoors. The activists have chained themselves into a ring around a pillar in the foyer. Curious employees pour out of the hallways. Police come from behind the cameraman, trying to manage the disintegrating situation. The protesters have drilled for how to deploy as fast as possible. But in the real lobby, with milling employees and pursuing police, deployment isn't pretty. The scuffle splits Mimi and Douglas. They end up across from each other in the ring. They have 3 seconds to lock down. Douglas sticks his left arm in the Black Bear and attaches the carabiner on his wrist cable to the steel post welded into the center of the tube.
His companions do the same. Seconds later, the whole nine-node ring solidifies into something impervious to anything short of a diamond saw. They sit cross-legged in a circle on the floor around a fat pillar. Douglas tilts to one side and still can't see her. He shouts, "Meme!" And that round brown face he has come to associate with all the world's goodness peeks around and grins. He shoots her a thumbs up, before remembering his thumb is inside a steel cylinder. One long tracking shot records each close-up. A tall, gawky man with a gap between his front teeth and long, bushy hair pulled back in a ponytail starts to sing. "We shall overcome. We shall overcome." There are snickers at first. But by measure three, the rest of the group is singing along. Five policemen tug at the demonstrators, but easy disentanglement is not an option. A uniformed man says, as if reading from a prompter, "My name is Sheriff Sanders. Your presence here is in violation of the Penal Code, section numbers." Shouts from the ring drown him out. He stops, closes his eyes, and starts again. "This is private property. I order you, on behalf of the state of Oregon, to disperse. If you do not withdraw peacefully, you will be held for unlawful assembly as well as trespass with criminal intent. Any attempt to resist arrest will be considered in violation of the Penal Code sections." The gawky, gap-toothed man shouts over him, "You should be joining us down here!" The officer recoils. Someone off camera calls, "You're all criminals! You just want to shit on other people!" The ring starts chanting again. More police crowd the circle's circumference. The sheriff steps forward again. His speech is slow, clear, and loud, like a grade school teacher's. "Release your hands from whatever restraints from inside your tubes. If you do not release yourselves within 5 minutes, we intend to use pepper spray to compel you to comply." Someone in the ring says, "You can't do that!" The camera settles on a small Asian woman with round face and black bob. Off camera, the sheriff says, "We certainly can, and we will." There's shouting from the ring. The camera doesn't know where to point. The round-faced woman can be heard saying, "It's forbidden under United States law for any public official to use pepper spray unless he's in danger. Look at us. We can't even move." The sheriff consults his watch. 3 minutes. Everyone talks at once. A pan across the confused lobby cuts back to frightened close-ups. There's a scuffle. A young man in the ring gets kicked in the kidney from behind. The camera swings and lands on the gap-toothed man. His ponytail whips back and forth.
"She's asthmatic, man! Bad! You can't use pepper spray on an asthmatic! People die from that, man!"
Someone off camera calls, "Do what the officer says!" The gap-toothed man nods like his neck is broken.
"Do it, Mimi! Unlock! Do it!"
The gray-haired woman shouts him down.
"We all agreed to stay in this together."
The sheriff calls out,
"You are in violation of the law, and your actions are damaging to the community. Please vacate these premises. You have 60 seconds.
60 seconds pass in the same confusion.
"I'm asking you again to unlock and remove your hands from those tubes and leave peacefully. I won an Air Force Cross for being shot down protecting this country. I gave the order for you to disperse over 5 minutes ago. You have been warned of the consequences, and you have accepted them."
"I don't accept them."
"We will now use pepper spray and other chemical agents to get you to release your hands from your metal pipes. We will continue to apply these agents
until you agree to release yourselves. Are you ready to release now and avoid this application?
Douglas leans one way, then the other. He can't see her. The pole is between them, and the ring is going nuts. He yells her name, and she's there, tilting her scared gaze into his. He shouts things she can't hear over all the other noise. They lock eyes for the tiniest forever. He rushes a dozen urgencies into that narrow channel.
You don't have to do this. You're worth more to me than all the forests this outfit can slaughter.
Her look is even thicker with messages, all of which come down to the hardest of nibs. Douglas. Douglas. What they do?
They start at the body nearest the sheriff's feet. A woman in her 40s, overweight, with blonde-tipped hair and last year's stylish glasses. An officer comes up behind her, holding a paper cup in one hand and a Q-tip in the other. The sheriff's voice is calm.
Do not resist. Any threats toward us will be considered an assault on a police officer, which is a felony.
We're locked up! We're locked up!
A second officer comes alongside the one with the swab and paper cup. He reaches down and restrains the woman with one hand while tipping her head back with the other. The woman blurts,
I teach biology at Jefferson Junior High. I have given 20 years to teaching kids about...
Someone off camera shouts, You're about to get schooled!
The sheriff says, Release yourself from the tube! The teacher sucks in her breath. There's shouting. The officer with the swab brings it down into the woman's right eye. He struggles to get a little more into her left. Chemicals pool under the lid and stream down the side of the woman's tipped-back face. The woman's moans are pure animal. Each one rises in pitch until she's screaming. Someone shouts,
Stop it! Now! We have water for your eyes. Release yourself and we'll give it to you. Are you going to release yourself?
The assisting officer tips her head back again, and the one with the swab spreads it into her eyes and nose.
Release yourself, and we'll give you cool water to rinse with.
Someone yells,
You're killing her! She needs a doctor!
The cop with the swab waves toward his backup.
We're going to use mace next. It's much worse.
The woman's screams collapse into bleating. She's too sunk into her pain to release. Her hands can't find the carabiner to unclick it. The two communion servers proceed clockwise to the next person in the ring, a muscular man in his early 30s who looks more like a logger than an owl lover. He clamps down his head and clenches shut his eyes.
Sir, are you going to release?
His broad, strong shoulders curl inward, but the black bears on both his arms keep him splayed. The assisting officer fights to bend back the man's head. Leverage is with the police, and when a third officer steps in to help, the neck is soon crooked. Getting the eyes open is not as clean. They work the swab into the eyelid slits while locking the great head. Concentrated pepper slops all over. A thimbleful gets up his nose and he starts to choke. The camera slashes around the room. It hovers on the window outside, where the crowd of protesters on the lawn chants with no clue what is happening indoors. The choking sounds are broken by an officer.
Are you going to release? Sir? Sir, can you hear me? Are you ready to let go?
Someone yells,
Don't you have a conscience?
Someone shrieks,
Use the bottle! Squirt their eyes!
This is torture! In America!
The camera turns dizzy. It bobs like a drunk. Words pour out of Douglas as the cops disappear behind the pillar.
She's asthmatic! You can't use pepper spray on her, man! For God's sake, it'll kill her!
He leans hard to his right, against the pinch of the black bears. He sees the officers flanking her, the uniformed man bending down from behind and taking her head in a loving embrace, gangbanged in the eyes by three guys. The sheriff says,
Ma'am,
Just release your arms and you can walk away. It doesn't have to hurt.
The woman past Mimi retches. Douglas shouts Mimi's name. The officer with the swab cups her neck with one hand.
Miss, would you like to release?
Please don't hurt me. I don't want to be hurt.
Then just release.
Douglas wrenches almost double.
Let go!
Mimi's eyes lock onto his. They flash crazy, and her nostrils quiver like a snared rabbit's. He doesn't understand the look, some kind of prediction. Her eyes say, whatever happens, remember what I tried to do. The police tip back her beautiful head. Her throat opens onto a gurgled,
ah!
Then he remembers. He can move. So easy. He fumbles with the clips that fasten his wrists to the black bear's center posts, and he's free. He scrambles up, howling,
back off!
It's not that things slow down. It's that his brain speeds up faster than the movements of men. He has all the minutes in the world to think several times, assaulting a police officer, felony, 10 to 12 years in prison. The police have him cuffed and spread-eagled on the floor before he can even start to swing. Before anyone can call, timber! That night, a shaken camera operator dupes the tape and leaks a copy to the press. Dennis brings squash soup to Patricia's cabin for lunch.
Patty, I don't know if I should even bring this up.
She headbutts his shoulder.
A little late to wonder, isn't it?
The injunction isn't going to hold. It's over already.
She pulls back and sobers.
What does that mean?
They said on the television last night. Another court decision. The Forest Service isn't bound by the temporary stay handed down in your hearing.
Not bound?
They're ready to approve a backlog of new harvest plans. People are going nuts all over the state. There was an action at the headquarters of a logging company. The police poured chemicals into people's eyes.
What? Then that doesn't sound right.
They showed a clip. I couldn't watch.
Are you sure? Here?
I saw it.
But you just said you couldn't watch.
I saw it.
His tone slaps her. They're fighting, something neither of them knows how to do. Dennis, too, ducks his head in shame. Bad dog, we'll do better. She takes his hand. They sit over their empty soup bowls, peering at a narrow opening in the copse of hemlocks. The questions the judge asked at the hearing come back to her. What use is wilderness? What difference will it make once the right to unlimited prosperity turns all forests into geometric proofs? The wind blows and the hemlocks wave their feathery, leading shoots. Such a graceful profile, so elegant a tree. A tree embarrassed for people, embarrassed by efficiency, injunctions. The bark gray, the branches beginner green. The needles flat along the shoots, pointing outward and on. The habit, tranquil, philosophical even, in its repose. Its cones, small, downward sleigh bells, content in constant silence. She's the guilty one, breaking that silence, when it just starts to get interesting.
In their eyes?
Pepper spray. With cotton swabs. It looked like something out of not this country.
People are so beautiful.
He turns to her, horrified. But he's a man of faith and waits to hear whatever explanation she cares to deliver. And yes, she thinks. The thought makes her stubborn. Yes, beautiful and doomed. Which is why she has never been able to live among them.
Hopelessness makes them determined. Nothing's more beautiful than that.
You think we're hopeless?
Then, how is extraction ever going to stop? It can't even slow down. The only thing we know how to do is grow. Grow harder, grow faster, more than last year. Growth all the way up to the cliff and over. No other possibility.
I see.
Clearly he doesn't. But his willingness to lie for her also breaks her heart. She would tell him how the towering, teetering pyramid of large living things is toppling down already, in slow motion, under the huge swift kick that has dislodged the planetary system. The great cycles of air and water are breaking. The tree of life will fall again, collapse into a stump of invertebrates, tough ground cover, and bacteria. Unless man. People are putting their bodies in the line of fire, even here in this land where the damage has long since been done, where this year's losses are nothing compared to those racked up in the distant south. People beaten and abused, people getting their eyes swabbed with pepper, while she who knows that 1 trillion leaves are lost without replacement every day, she has done nothing.
Would you say I'm a peaceful man?
Oh, then, you're almost as peaceful as a plant.
I feel miserable. I want to hurt those cops.
She squeezes his hand in time to the swaying hemlocks.
People. So much pain.
They pack the dirty dishes into his truck for the ride back to town. She grabs him at the car door.
I'm a rich woman, right?
Not rich enough to run for public office, if that's what you're thinking.
She laughs too hard for the joke and sobers too quickly.
In situ preservation is failing. And I see now it always will.
He looks at her and waits. She thinks, if the rest of the species were as comfortable with looking and waiting as this man, we might yet be saved.
I want to start a seed bank. There are half as many trees in the world as there were before we came down out of them.
Because of us?
1% of the world forest every decade. An area larger than Connecticut every year.
He nods, as if no one paying attention would be surprised.
1/3 to 1/2 of existing species may go extinct by the time I'm gone.
Her words puzzle him. She's going somewhere?
Tens of thousands of trees we know nothing about, species we've barely classified, like burning down the library, art museum, pharmacy, and hall of records all at once.
You want to start an ark?
She smiles at the word, but shrugs. It's as good as any.
I want to start an ark.
Where you can keep...
The strangeness of the idea gets him. A vault to store a few 100 million years of tinkering. Hand on the car door, he fixes on something high up in a cedar.
What would you do with them? When would they ever...
Then, I don't know. But a seed can lie dormant for thousands of years.
They meet on a hillside at evening, overlooking the sea. Father and son. It has been some time. After this hour together in a brand new place, it will be so much longer.
Nileji, is that you?
Pita, here we are. It works.
The old beggar walks up to the blue-skinned god and waves. The god stands still.
Sound is very bad, Nile.
I can hear you, Dad. Not to worry. It's just you and me.
I can't believe it. So amazing.
This is nothing. Just wait.
The blue god stumbles as he tries to walk.
Look at your costume. Look at me.
Hoping to make you laugh, Peter.
Side by side, with shaky steps, they make their way along the ocean-battered cliffs. Since long before the father left for that clinic in distant Minnesota, such a walk together has been impossible. Not since the boy's early childhood have they gone out like this, chattering side by side, their words rushing to keep up with their steps.
It's so big, Nile.
There's more. Lots more.
And the details. How did you do it?
Peter, this is just the beginning. Trust me.
The blue god staggers up to the cliff's edge.
My goodness! Look down there! Waves!
They stand at the top of a waterfall that plunges down onto the coast below. Surf-carved rocks dot the sand like fairy castles. Tidal pools shimmer beneath.
Nile, so beautiful. I want to see it all.
They follow the coast a while before turning inland.
Where are we now? What is this place?
It's all imaginary, Peter.
Yes, but familiar.
That's good.
The father will tell the boy's mother afterward how he was plucked up and dropped back down in the infant world before the rise of people. The misty air and slant tropical light confuse him. The tan of the sand and azure sea, the dry mountains ringing them in. He squints at the vegetation, so lavish. He has never paid much attention to plants. He never had time in his life to learn them, and now he never will. They walk down a path alongside trunks that open into giant, gnarled parasols against the sun.
What on earth, Nile? Your sci-fi?
As if his son's pulp magazines still gather dust balls in stacks under the boyhood bed.
No, Peter. Earth. Dragon blood trees.
They're real? Trees like that in our world?
The beggar smiles and points.
Everything based on a true story.
It dawns on the blue god. The fish in these seas, the birds in the air, and all that creeps on this made earth is just a crude start for some future refuge, saved from the vanishing original. He walks up close to one of the monster toadstools.
What can the players do with this place?
The words spill out of the beggar, unplanned.
What do you want it to do, Dad?
Ah, Nile, I remember. Good answer.
The beggar describes just how large the sandbox is. A person can gather herbs, hunt animals, plant crops, cut trees and fashion boards, dig deep mines for minerals and ore, trade and negotiate, build cabins and town halls and cathedrals and world wonders. They walk again. The climate changes to something lusher. Beasts prowl in the undergrowth. Above them, flocks wheel.
When do people start to arrive?
End of next month.
I see. Soon.
You'll still be here, Dad.
Yes, of course, Nile.
How do I nod again?
The blue god learns to nod. So much new to learn.
What happens then?
Then, we get flooded. 500,000 have signed up already. $20 a month. We're planning for a few million.
I'm glad to see it like this, before.
Yes, just the two of us.
The novice Vishnu stumbles up the trail. They have mountains to cross now, vine-covered canyons. The god stands for a moment, awed by his surroundings. Then he wanders down the forest path again.
Only a quarter century, Dad, since we wrote that Hello World program, and the curve is still heading straight upwards.
From 2,000 miles apart,
For a few trillion cycles of the processor's clock, a processor descended from the one the blue-skinned god helped build, father and son look across the mountains together and into the future. This land of animated wishes will expand without limits. It will fill with richer, wilder, more surprising life beyond life. The map will grow as full as the thing it stands for. And still, people will be hungry and alone. They walk along magnificent crests. Far below, a wide old river meanders through a jungle dense with many greens. The blue god stands and looks. All his life, he has been homesick. Yearning drove him from a village in Gujarat to the Golden State. He has had no country except for work and family. And all his life he has thought, it's only me. Now he looks down on the snaking river. Millions will pay a monthly rent to come here. And he'll be gone.
Where are we now, Neeliji?
It doesn't work like that, Dad. All brand new.
Yes. No. I understand. But these plants and animals. We've walked from Africa into Asia?
Follow me. I'll show you something. The beggar leads them down a switchback into the thickening jungle. They enter a maze of twisty trails all alike. Creatures dart through the undergrowth.
Neem trees, Neely. Magic!
Wait, there's more. The jungle thickens and the trail thins. Shapes play in the fronds and creeping vines. Then the father sees it, hidden in the foliage of this sprawling simulation, a ruined temple, swallowed by a single fig.
Oh, my prince, you've really made something.
Not just me. Hundreds of people. Thousands, really. I don't even know their names. You're in here, too. The work you did. The beggar turns. He waves at the roots that snake across the ancient stones, looking for cracks to slither into and sip from. He raises the tip of his gnarled pinky.
You see, Peter, all from out of a seed this big.
Vishnu wants to ask, how do I make my eyes water? Instead, he says,
thank you, Neeli. I should go now.
Yes, Dad. I'll see you soon. It's a harmless enough lie. In this world, the beggar has just walked across half a continent. But in the other, he's too frail and wasted to risk an airplane. And the blue god, who has just crossed a jagged mountain range in bare feet, in the world above, his body is so riddled with rogue programs and syntax errors, he won't make it to this world's opening day. His puppet body nods, and his palms join together.
Thank you for this walk, dear Neeli. We'll be home soon.